in case anybody had any questions about the date. We're going to open, now we need another body.
New body consideration.
Yes. Sir Ferriello, do you have any concerns about any of the executive appointments?
None whatsoever.
Okay. All right. Let's go into work session on executive appointments. We need to do each one of these separately. My huge apologies to the audience. Rich Brown, Rebecca Hernandez, and Jean Phelps to the State Commission on Children and Families. Chair would open a work session on executive appointments. Chair would move State Commission on Children and Families appointments of Brown, Hernandez, and Phelps to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Ringo, would you please carry? Did you carry the last set?
I carried everybody.
Okay, let's do Shields then. All right, unless one of you guys want to carry.
It's your pleasure, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Senator Ferriello, thank you for volunteering. All right, let's open a work session on Employment Appeals Board. Chair would move Sarah Owens to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. State Housing Council. Chair would move Gina Woolley to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Richard Allen to the State Marine Board. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Betty Griffith to the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Pamela Holst Andrews, Carl Talton, Walter Van Valkenburg to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Bridget Burns, Adriana Mendoza, Howard Sohn, and Tony Van Fleet to the State Board of Higher Education. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Catherine Liu to State Board of Pharmacy. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Eric Kvarsten, Eric Meyer, Eric Swanson. Must have a thing for Eric's there these days. To the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Katie Cuba and Joe D'Alessandro to the Oregon Tourism Commission. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Yvonne Williams to the Trustees of the State Library. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Steve Corey, Judith Johansson, and Junkie Yoshida to the Board of Commissioners of the Port of Portland. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move Sarah Vickerman to the Sustainability Board. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move George Richardson, Timothy Schweitzer to the TriMet Board. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And finally, Chair would move Holly Scholes, the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Will you carry those, Senator Ferriello?
Madam, I will.
Yes.
Thank you. We appreciate you volunteering for this particular duty.
Committee, I'm going to take a picture of the committee.
Yeah. We'll make sure you're not left in a lurch. I didn't move the Oregon Lottery Commission so we can have a caucus conversation. So. All right. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3090. Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, yesterday we looked at the national...
We need to do a motion to reconsider. Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, yesterday we looked at the Dash 11 amendments and Dash 12 amendments, and we believe that they were identical when, in fact, there was a very slight difference. That difference was made at the request of SEIU, and the difference is that the county clerks under the Dash 12s aren't required to create a form, but they may create a form for people to use in saying whether placing unofficial drop boxes. And SEIU, that was an important difference for them. And so that's why the Dash 12s were created, and those are the ones that I think we should have moved.
Okay. Did you want to make the motion?
So, Madam Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and reconsider the vote yesterday by which we adopted House Bill 3090.
Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, I move that we rescind our decision to adopt the Dash 11s. And instead adopt the Dash 12 amendments to House Bill 3090.
Senator Ringo has moved that we adopt, instead of the A11s, the A12s to House Bill 3090. I believe that this motion will make the county clerks happier.
Point of order, Madam Chair.
Senator Farrielly.
The motion is to remove the dash 11s and insert the dash 12s.
That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3090 as amended with the dash 12 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved 3090 as amended with the dash 12 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, let's go to 2154. Okay. All right. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2154. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2154 allows the governor to assign counties and municipal resources across jurisdictional lines if necessary to respond to a collapse or the threat of a structural collapse.
All right, I've got Nancy Orr and Bob Garrison. Please come on up. All right, go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Brown, members of the committee, Nancy Orr, State Farm Marshal. With me is Bob Garrison, recently retired State Farm Marshal. We appreciate very much your consideration and promptly scheduling a hearing on this bill. This bill is needed to authorize Oregon's new urban search and rescue resources, both trained responders and equipment, to respond to any community that has experienced a structural collapse. After 3 years of preparation, we now have trained responders as well as three caches of equipment, $1 million worth of equipment purchased with Homeland Security grants. Those caches are located in Clackamas, Marion, and Lane counties for response statewide. Without this legislation, this team and the resources can only respond among those fire departments that have signed a mutual aid agreement. So this bill is needed to serve communities outside of those served by Portland, Hillsborough, Tualatin Valley, Gresham, Clackamas 1, Salem, Marion County 1, Eugene, and Springfield. This bill is supported by the Oregon Fire Chiefs, Fire District Directors, Volunteer Firefighters, and the State Fire District, the State Firefighters Council.
Thank you. Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Robert Garrison, and I serve as a citizen advisor for the Oregon Urban Search and Rescue Task Force. I'd like to make the point that these jurisdictions that the State Fire Marshal just mentioned, along with the Department of Transportation, Oregon Emergency Management, and the Office of State Fire Marshal, have gone to a great deal of trouble to get people trained to do this work. We now have some 200 trained rescue technicians. That has been at the expense of their employers, mostly the fire departments that were just mentioned. We have these three identical caches ready to respond to these kinds of emergencies. But we can move the equipment. The governor can move the equipment anywhere in the state, but he cannot move those trained responders. It's very important that we have this bill so that the responders can be moved with the equipment. And for that reason, we request your favorable consideration on this. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and would certainly be willing to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions from the committee? All right. You wowed them. You're okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Any amendments to House Bill 2154? All right. Let's move into work session on House Bill 2154. There are no amendments. The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. 2154. When we just heard. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry? Senator Atkinson is refusing to look at me now since every time he does, I let him carry a bill. All right, Senator Shields, thank you for volunteering.
Thank you so much.
All right, so we're going to move into public hearing on House Bill 2510. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee heard House Bill 2510A on the 5th, and we're hearing it again today. This is the bill that expands the types of written instruments that would be subject to the statutes governing the crime of forgery. What the bill does is it adds certain types of retail sales receipts to the class of written instruments that are subject to the law, and we have a dash A2 amendment before us.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Brandis, Ms. Skye, anybody else wishing to testify on this bill?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Julie Brandis, representing Associated Oregon Industries and its retail council. This is the shoplifting bill of the session. I'm sorry it's not as exciting as the metal underpants bill from last session. I really tried to think of something exciting. But
it was a tough act to follow, Ms.
Brandis. A tough act to follow. There is a new type of crime that is occurring in our states. 22 states have already acted to implement similar legislation. The existing forgery laws do not adequately deal with how criminals are utilizing UPC codes and the machines that create UPC codes to mismark items within the stores and then purchase those items for a higher price and then come back to the store and return them for the cash, and then they take a walk. So it's a large problem. Forgery laws deal with documents. This legislation deals with the documents, the machine, and the machines used to make the documents. So we have worked on the House side with the defense lawyers and the prosecuting attorneys to come up with an agreement. I think you have another amendment which we're happy to accommodate in this legislation.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ms. Skye.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and the A2 amendments are from my organization. What the A2 amendments seek to do is to update the financial amounts in the statute, basically to adjust them due to inflation. The amounts set in the statute, $750, that level determines whether a case will be forgery in the second degree, a Class A misdemeanor, or forgery in the first degree, a Class C felony. Those amounts were put in the statute in 1993, so it hasn't been updated in 12 years. This idea came from one of our members who actually suggested it for the theft statutes, and OCDLA does have a bill, which I believe is lost in the House Budget Committee right now, which seeks to adjust those levels in the theft statutes, and AOI was gracious enough to allow us to amend this into the forgery statutes. What we did was just go onto the Oregon Department of Revenue website, put in the Consumer Price Index, put in $750. It came near 1,000, and that's how we arrived at that figure.
Okay. Questions? Good job. Appreciate you guys working together on this one. All right. Chair, we close the public hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2510. Okay, I won't look at you, Senator Atkinson. Chair would move the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2510. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who wants to volunteer? Come on, you guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can you still talk about the metal underpants?
I can work it in. It'll be germane.
All right. I'd like to say Senator Atkinson can talk about anything he wants to on the Senate floor, but we have somewhat of a germaneness issue. Let's go to 2581, from metal underpants to worms. Ms. Harris.
Thanks, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 2581 declares vermiculture to be an agricultural activity, and yes, for the Committee's information, vermiculture is the breeding of worms, and the significance of that designation...
This is a bill?
Bill. The significance of the agricultural activity designation is that now worms can be regulated as agricultural commodities.
Thank you, Ms. Harris.
I'm a fly fisherman. I might object to this bill.
Mr. Holcomb.
Save a fly. Save a worm.
Come on up.
Must be fun testifying on this.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
At least everybody gets a good laugh.
you really dig it, right?
We just need to know your name for the record and why we need this bill.
Okay, well, my name is Dan Holcomb. I own Oregon Soil Corporation. Since 1988, we've endeavored to bring vermiculture to a municipal level to deal with municipal waste volumes. I can't raise worms and sell equipment on commercial property. It's too expensive. I just sold three systems to R&D Solutions in New York. Cost $28,000 because I couldn't buy worms cheaper than $11 a pound in Washington. So a guy in Illinois got them for $8.50. And so I lost $26,000 out of that sale that I could have got. I need to be able to raise them on agricultural property. Okay. Commercial property is too expensive.
All right. And Mr. Holcomb, where do you live?
Oregon City.
Okay. All right. Questions?
Madam Chair?
Sarinko.
How much physical space do you need to raise worms?
Space. So it depends on how large you get. Commercially, we build systems that are 8 to 10 feet wide and as long as you want to make them, and they handle about 6 pounds per square foot. In a windrow or in a covered poly house, you know, you're going to have several poly houses 30, 40 feet wide and 200 or 300 feet long, and you'll have material in there to raise them.
I see. Madam Chair, just so you can envision operations of several acres?
Yes. I wouldn't say right away, but I could imagine pretty easily, yeah. If the equipment sells, and with our next SBIR proposal to the EPA, if we can show pathogen control and get accepted by the pathogen review committee, then it goes to an accepted methodology for dealing with organic waste. Right now, it's on a site-specific issue, and you have to test and retest to show pathogen control. We've had two phase ones and two phase twos from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the SBIR program. The castings is the product. It enhances plant growth, protects against plant disease and pests, gets a healthier, hardier plant.
I'm not quite following you, but I'm trying to understand. You said the reason to be on EFU is because it's cheaper than commercial.
Can't afford to buy commercial property.
But it's not because your operation needs to be in conjunction with nearby farming operations.
Not necessarily, no, because we build the equipment for them, and we can ship that anywhere. The idea is to be able to raise the worms in an agricultural setting so that I don't have to raise cows or raise something else or do another agricultural activity in conjunction to have the worm. It takes too much time. You got 8-10 hours a day when you're feeding, 50-60,000 pounds of worms or more. Anyhow, that was the reason for it, was to get it accepted so there can be a principal income from a farm instead of having to do it in conjunction with something else.
So, Ringo?
What about
on
land that's zoned industrial?
It's too expensive. I can't afford to buy it.
Well, and I'm sorry, just a comment. I mean, you could apply that to any business in our state. They'd say, fine, we want to go put our business on EFU because it's cheaper.
No, because it's an agricultural activity. We produce an agricultural product. If we could get it to a volume of 50 tons a week, the mill would save us a silo as a food protein source.
That's the connection I'm trying to understand.
Oh, okay.
And I asked you, is there a reason to be close to agricultural activity? And you said, not really. It's only
Well, I wasn't energy. Thinking on those lines particularly because I've been working towards developing the mechanical technology to accommodate the worms to do what they do. But to be able to do and build systems and accommodate municipalities, besides the fact that they are a protein source, and you can go into aviaries, you can go into fisheries, the castings are a very high-grade agricultural soil amendment. Presently, it's been approved to be sold as a plant food and a fertilizer. We can't get it sold as an organic fertilizer certified yet because we know the results, but we're not sure of the means that it gets there.
Okay. Mr. Holcomb, just help me understand. If you had this set up in an EFU area, what will be the interaction between that, the operation, and the nearby farming operations?
Other than probably getting their manure or feed, I don't know what interaction you would be looking for.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we can address dairy issues. We can address any meat operation. We can address any dairy operation as far as their waste material to bring it to a volume. But the idea is to be able to sell, to be able to grow a large enough volume that we can address, you know, other issues with them.
Okay. Anybody else have any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
And after session, some of us would really enjoy a tour. I'm serious.
Okay. Well, we're up in Oregon City. You say hey, or when you get a break?
When we get a break.
Today.
Okay. I'll go today.
Okay.
How about right now, madam?
My step.
All right. Closed public hearing, open work session. No amendments, right? House Bill 2581.
Yes.
Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a good pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Rico?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferry?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. I don't think we should let Senator Shields carry this bill. Do you all?
I don't know.
I think Senator Ringo wants to. He told me he wants to carry it.
Senator Shields, since you volunteered.
I'll yes. endeavor to keep a straight face.
Okay. And no puns, please.
That I didn't suggest.
All right. Let's go back over to work sessions. We have a number of bills to work session. Sigh, everyone. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2060. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2060 authorizes the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to set up an optional retirement plan for administrative and academic employees of community college districts who would also be eligible for PERS membership. We have several amendments before us.
All right. Ms. Satinsfield, you want to come on up? Are you the owner of all the amendments?
Yes.
Okay.
American A6 I just saw.
Yes.
There is an A6.
Okay. Are those yours as well?
No.
Okay. All right. Why don't you tell us about the Dash 5s, please?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Lori Satinsfield, the Oregon Community College Association. The A5s are inclusive of 2, 3, and 4. They've addressed concerns via the governor's office to have an optional retirement plan for our community college administrators. They have a revocable option to leave PERS and go to an optional retirement plan. Another change. We narrowed the focus to administrative employees only, and that about covers the 2, 3, 4, and 5. very limited.
Okay. We appreciate, I know you've worked this bill very hard, and we appreciate your persistence in keeping this bill moving forward. Anybody have any questions for Ms. Satinsfield? All right. Thank you very much. Guess you're up the hook. We're in work session on House Bill 2060. Chair would move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2060. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill to this, as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Hold on just a sec.
Okay.
So the A6s, that's not part of the motion you just made?
That's correct. Would you like to have a conversation about the A6s?
Where did the A... Can we talk about the A6s?
Sure. Do you know where they came from?
I'm thinking they might have come from me. There are lots of things happening.
We think so, too, Senator Atkinson.
But we don't have its advocate here, do we?
All right.
We do not.
There's a motion on the table. The chair would withdraw the motion if you want to go find the advocate and have a conversation.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair doesn't withdraw the motion, which was to move House Bill 2060 as amended with the dash 5 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Rico?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farrelly?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Who'd like to carry? Sarah Ringo, thank you for volunteering. All right. Let's go into work session on House Bill 2525. Let's go into work session on House Bill 2525, Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2525A amends the statutes governing dispute resolution processes for construction defect claims.
3-A8 amendments?
We have several amendments. We have the dash A4 through the dash A8.
Mr. Hagedorn, anybody else you need to bring up? Okay.
Thank you and good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Drew Hagedorn. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers in support of the A10 amendments to House Bill 2525. The amendments' winery-related language, sections 1 through 3, evolved from discussions with the Oregon Building Codes Division regarding last year's adoption of the 2003 International Building Code. When the division adopted the national code, the code unintentionally defined wineries in a manner inconsistent with past practice that subjected the industry to unnecessary and costly requirements when constructing or remodeling wine-producing facilities. In working with the division to craft an administrative solution, we also learned that the existing administrative rulemaking procedure would take several months to a year, preventing several pending projects from moving forward. The A10 amendments developed in conjunction with the Building Codes Division remedy both problems. First, they define wineries for purposes of the state building code, providing the division clear guidance in adopting future administrative rule. Second, they provide the division flexibility to address the wine growers' concerns through an expedited administrative rulemaking process. This will allow pending projects to move forward without further delay. There's no known opposition, and I urge your support for the A10 amendments. The remainder of the amendment, I should say, incorporates the dash 6 amendment that you heard testimony on yesterday. I know the proponents are here, so if you have any questions regarding that portion, you can ask them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Hagedorn? Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. All right, we're in work session. Chair would move the dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2525. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move the bill as amended with the dash 10 amendments to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection?
That's good.
Hearing and seeing none? So ordered. Who would like to carry?
Madam Chair.
Sarah Atkinson, you would like to carry? Thanks for volunteering. All right. Let's move into work session on House Bill 2591. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. We heard House Bill 2591 a few days ago. It's before us again. We don't have any amendments. This is the bill that modifies mostly the discovery procedures and litigation involving food establishments.
Thank you. Anybody needing to hear from the proponents or opponents of this bill?
Madam Chair, I would like 2 seconds to get a recap of this. This is
okay. What do you guys want to come up? Mr. Perry. Okay, Mr. Perry.
All right, yep. For the record, my name is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I want to start out by saying I appreciate the fact that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association worked extensively on this bill with us to make sure that we addressed all their concerns. It does basically two basic things. First is it really limits what lawsuits it impacts. It only deals with lawsuits that are strictly from weight gain or obesity. Alterated food, all that other stuff is still excluded from this bill. And the other thing is that it deals with discovery until after a motion to dismiss are addressed. And I'll let the officially smart person probably address anything more technical than that.
Just a question. On what you just said, Bill, that relates to lawsuits relating solely to claims of obesity, of weight gain.
That is correct.
I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
Madam Chair, for your record, Bill Linden, Oregon Restaurant Association. I'd only add that we spent quite a number of hours negotiating language changes with Rich Lane, the legislative affairs director for the trial lawyers. They are now neutral on the bill, and we think it represents a nice balanced approach to this issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? All right. Thanks. Both of you? All right. We're in work session.
Madam Chairman.
Sarah Farrielli.
Where are we? I would move the... There are no amendments.
No amendments.
I'd move the bill to the House recommendation.
Senator Farrielli has moved House Bill 2591 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none? So ordered. You want to carry? Okay.
I'll take the order.
Thank you, Senator Farrielli.
I thought you had to have a lawyer to carry this one.
Oh. All right. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3497. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 3497A is the bill that we heard on the 6th. It's before us again. Don't have any amendments that I am aware of. This is the bill that establishes a priority of allocations for the criminal fine and assessment account. Colleagues, I just sort of needed a day or two to kind of rehash this bill in my mind and make sure we were doing the right things. Does anybody have any concerns or comments about the bill? All right. Chair would move the bill. We have no amendments, correct?
Correct.
Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We're going to let Senator Burdick carry the bill. Keeps her out of trouble and off the streets. All right. Let's move into work session for House Bill 2056. This is a bill that there are some contentious issues. The bill has a referral to the Senate Budget Committee. The chair would move the bill without recommendation to the Senate Budget Committee. Any discussion?
Sure.
Senator Ringo.
Just slow down 1 second.
Sure, sure.
What's that?
You want to talk to me for a minute?
Jason does. Sure.
All right. Chair's moved the bill to the Senate Budget Committee. Any discussion?
This one we had a hearing on yesterday.
That's correct.
The City of Portland works against.
Correct. All right. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator
Gio? I don't think so. No.
Vice Chair Farrelly?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Do we do 3497? Let's go back up to the one you've all been waiting. I think the TV cameras were waiting for. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2671. Thank you. Well, there was a TV camera here earlier. I don't think it, no offense, Mr. Campbell, but I don't think it was on the vermiculture bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, they left right after the vermiculture bill, so possibly it was about one.
We're here to offer all of our horse manure for the worm farm.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Campbell representing Magna Entertainment, and joining me is my partner in crime, Dave Nelson, also with Magna. Magna has been operating horse racing at the Portland Meadows Racetrack.
And here we're here today requesting that you take affirmative action on House Bill 2671A engrossed, which would allow 30 lion games at Portland Meadows. This has had a very interesting trip through the legislative process. It started as 50 lion games, and we were convinced that 50 lion games maybe looked more like a casino than we wanted it to. So we agreed that we would reduce it to 30 lion games. Magna has 20 video poker machines. They had 10 at Portland Meadows and 10 at the Greyhound track. And since the dog track will no longer operate, the 10 at that location are being eliminated. In place of the 20 at the two locations, we're basically requesting 30 at one location to be placed at Portland Meadows track. Magna basically acquired Portland Meadows in 2001, and unfortunately, there's been a tremendous number of competitive entities that have hurt horse racing in the state of Oregon. I point out that our request really isn't just to maintain horse racing in the state, but it's more importantly is to maintain the entire horse industry in the state of Oregon. Now, the racing industry supports about 3,000 Oregon jobs, primarily in the agricultural sector or directly relating to horse racing. And the economic impact of the racing industry on the Oregon economy exceeds $150 million per year. Since 2001, there's been a continued expansion of Indian casinos. Just recently, of course, the governor has agreed to an off-reservation casino for the Warm Springs Tribe in Cascade Locks. But I'll tell you the thing that has worried us far more in competitive and doing damage to racing in Oregon is the track that 16 miles north of our track, where they're considering putting one of the largest casinos in the Northwest. It'll be a combined Cowlitz and Connecticut Mohegan Tribe major event. Substantial increases in video poker have also taken a toll on our horse racing wagering dollars, and the recent decision to allow line games is the most recent challenge or opportunity, depending on what you folks do to us or for us. As the competitive activities have grown, the decline in Oregon's live handle, those are the dollars actually bet on horse racing, has dropped substantially from about $24 million in 95 to $18.2 million in 2000, $14.9 million in 2004, so you can see a steady decline. During the past 4 years, our client has invested $21 million in purchasing Portland Meadows operating rights, real estate interest and track improvements. And due to the previous owner's failure to correct a problem, EPA closed the operation in 2002, and that problem was stormwater entering the Columbia River Slough, in other words, stormwater with horse manure in it. It cost $1 million to correct that problem, so racing could resume, and it did. In addition, Magna's operating losses have been almost $7 million. What we're trying to do is find a way of making Magna at break-even. At this point in time, we don't see an opportunity to do much better than that, and this is one of the issues that we've used to do that. You voted on year-round simulcasting a few months ago, and the governor signed that bill into law, and that really reduced our losses by about 50%. If we're unable to find a solution to declining income and increasing negative financial results, any business would, I believe, pull up stakes and leave the process. If that were to happen in Oregon, not only would horse racing and horse industry suffer, but we also would lose horse racing at the fair operations, which are in Primeville, Grants Pass, Tillamook. So we're here basically not to say that we want more gambling. I guess you could say 30 line games is gambling. But the important thing is we're here to save the horse industry. And we would hope that you would give positive consideration to our request. And we're prepared to respond to any questions you might have.
Mr. Nelson, anything you wish to add?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing Magna Entertainment Corporation. I've started raising quarter horse racehorses in the late 1960s and began representing Portland Meadows in 1976, and have done that and watched the decline, basically, resulting from the competition of the state's advance into the voluntary revenue business with the advent of the lottery and then video poker, which we opposed in 1991. We should have joined them at the time instead of opposing it, I suppose, and said cut out a piece of the action for the racing industry. However, we did oppose that advent into video poker. There have been a couple of questions in the House committee that I think are important. One is, where does we had an amendment in the House that we offered and then withdrew, and that was for the bill to specify a level of commission for to be paid to Portland Meadows. We withdrew that, and the lottery will set the commission rate, whatever that may be. That will be up to the lottery commission. The other issue is, does 30 video poker machines rise to the level of challenging the constitutionality of a casino? And in the case, there was a case in 1996 entitled Ecumenical Ministries versus the State of Oregon. And I think the issue there was what is the court's resolve of that issue was to determine or set forth the test of dominant purpose and dominant use. If you look at Portland Meadows in any relationship of dominant purpose or dominant use, whether it be size, whether it be economic revenue that comes to the facility, or whether it's the number of employees who are attentive to that particular activity. You look at the size, Portland Meadows is 115 acres. The number of video poker, the number of square feet per video poker machine, if you set that at 10 square feet per video poker machine, you've got 300 square feet. An acre is 42,350 square feet. So you don't, 115 acres, size isn't a dominant purpose or dominant that particular 115 acres. If you look at the financial result, wagering, Portland Meadows, revenue from racing is about $8 million, $3 million of that is for purses for horsemen. We anticipate Portland Meadows to receive $360,000 from the 30 video poker machines. That would be divided 50-50 for purses for horsemen, as well as to try to balance the books for the operation. If you look at the number of employees, Portland Meadows hires about 300, 350 employees. If there are four or five attentive to the video poker machines, you see there's absolutely no way that that can rise to be the dominant purpose or dominant use of the facility at Portland Meadows. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions. I think the bill is simply one that tries to help preserve the racing industry and the breeding and training industry that's in the state of Oregon today.
Thank you. Questions?
I'm sure.
Senator Ringo.
I just want to clarify that the 10 poker machines at the Greyhound Park racetrack, since that's not operating, the right to use those machines goes away.
It goes away.
Okay, you can't move them.
No, correct.
Okay. Seeing that case. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
You mentioned the simulcast. Is that the bill that came through my general government committee?
Correct.
Okay.
No other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
We're going to not move into work session on this bill today. So let's move down to HJM 37. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the resolution?
Thank you, Madam Chair. HJM 37 urges Congress to establish regulation of open ocean aquaculture. That's the growth.
Everybody's okay. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I'll let the experts define aquaculture.
Unfortunately, there's none here.
Ah.
So you are the expert for the day.
Great. Apparently, under current law, there is not a federally, there's no sort of federal oversight of open ocean aquaculture concerns. And this is, when I say aquaculture, it's a sort of a wide diversity of plant and animal species, including trout, shellfish, salmon, catfish, that type of thing, that are raised in the open ocean.
Okay. All right, we have no one here to testify on HJM. Oh, we do? HJM 37. Let's close the public hearing. Chair would open a work session and move HJM 37 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo?
I think we should
spend our time on what's important, and if proponents of a memorial can't even come time to testify, I wouldn't even move it.
I understand that, Senator Rangel, and normally that's my practice, except that we have, we're running out of time, and it's a resolution that a number of House members supported. Senator Farrielly.
I am a sponsor of this legislation, and I am here. And I like the bill. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill forward to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. All right. Just vote no. Okay. All right. Chairs move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Senator Rangel, be no. Motion carries. Senator Farrielly, would you please carry? Thank you. Oh, jeez. Let's go right up to House Bill 3486. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Sure. Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 3486A requires the state police to make information about certain sex offenders available to the public on the internet.
Ah, yes, it's the Senate Committee on Keeping House Members Happy, since they have nothing to do over in the House. Welcome, Representative Krummel. I'm just teasing you.
Well, and I'm just trying to appear as though I'm on official business, Madam Chair.
You look like you're on official business.
That's why I'm in the building.
That's good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Krummel, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Thank you for bringing up House Bill 3486. The recent case out of Northern Idaho involving the Groney family has hits close to home in many respects. The prosecutors are now saying that 42-year-old Joseph Duncan killed three members of the Groney family in Coeur d'Alene in order to kidnap the youngest children for sex. He was then allegedly hiding out in the woods molesting kids repeatedly for a couple of months until he was captured earlier this month. And the remains, as you know, of 9-year-old Dylan have been found in northwestern Montana. And his sister, Shasta, was found alive at a Denny's restaurant in Coeur d'Alene. I'm sure that she will be traumatized for life. This was not Duncan's first sexual offense. He was a level 3 sex offender on the run from charges in Minnesota that he abused another boy there last year. And I would add that he started when he was 17 abusing young boys, and it has gone on from there, and he's now 42. He had been in neighboring North Dakota, going to college since 2000, and authorities there thought he was so dangerous that when he arrived in Fargo, 300 people turned out for a neighborhood meeting about him in terms of notifying the neighborhood. Prior to his being in Fargo, Duncan served a 20-year sentence for raping a 14-year-old boy, and I mentioned that a few minutes ago, and that was in Tacoma, so he's from the Northwest. He beat the boy, sodomized him, and burned him with cigarettes. He has told therapists that he'd molested 13 other boys, and that was, like I mentioned, back when he was 17 years old. There are 48 states that have sex offender websites, and unfortunately, Oregon is not one of them. Only Oregon and South Dakota don't have a statewide website that people can go to get information about sex offenders that may be in their neighborhoods. There is a new federal registry that is was recently announced by U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and in his announcement he said it will provide a one-stop access to registries from the 48 states that have them, and we will work with the two remaining states to be sure that everyone gets on board with this important public notification system. I have to add that I was embarrassed that Oregon was one of the states that he was talking about having to work with. The current system in Oregon is woefully inadequate. It's confusing and frustrating, and it's for both citizens and for law enforcement. And, Madam Chair, if it would please you, I would like to bring up the person that actually brought this issue to me and said we need to do something, and she's a constituent of mine from Wilsonville, and her name is Connie Holland, and she's sitting right over here, so if it'd be all right with you to
sure.
bring her up.
Come on up. And do you mind if Mr. Dole comes up as well?
Pardon me?
Do you mind if Mr. Dole comes up?
Not at all.
Come on, Mr. Dole, why don't you come on up. Ms. Holland, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. name is Constance Holland, and I am from Wilsonville, Oregon. I have kind of become the poster child. I don't know if you get to see in media spots, but it's my mug all over the TV. This kind of started when my daughter goes to school in Eugene, so I pulled up the internet to send her a link. I don't know if you know a lot about college girls, but they're a little bit naive to the world around them. So I wanted to send her a link that would say, watch out for this guy, watch out for this guy, and I couldn't find it. So I started emailing anybody I could find. Representative Crummel got back to me. I think that my catalyst for this is my daughter was molested when she was four at a daycare provider's house, registered with the state of Connecticut. My brother was raped at six. So I think I have probably a first-hand experience on how these people affect the lives of others. It's destroyed my brother's life. He didn't tell anyone until he was 23, and he's in federal prison now. He self-medicated with drugs and took that life choice. Thankfully, not everybody that's been molested makes a choice as my brother has, but these people just destroy people in their wake. I was so frustrated that I could not go one place and pull. As my face has been all over the media, I think the most surprising thing to me is I work for a company that has 53,000 employees. I have received email after email. This happened to my brother. It happened to my mother. It happened to my sister. You go get him, girl. People that I hardly even know. I get it at the grocery store. I get it at Starbucks. I get it everywhere I go. So it's not just my story. It's a lot of people's story. And a lot of people want to be able to look.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mr. Dole.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I hope that someday we don't get to a point where we have to pass a bill in this body that we have to name after someone like Megan or like Jacob Wetterling or like Jessica Lunford, a little girl down in Florida, or like these poor unfortunate children in Idaho. Our history of sex offender notification in Oregon is as follows. In 1989, we passed a law requiring people convicted of certain sex crimes to register as sex offenders. In 1993, then State Representative Peter Courtney wrote Oregon's Community Notification Law. Then came the federal laws, Megan's Law and Jacob Wetterling Act. Megan's Law, in the state of New Jersey, and the Jacob Wetterling Act at the federal level, which deal with notification and sex offender registration requirements. Then in 1999, the Oregon legislature adopted Senate Bill 740 unanimously by the House and Senate to bring us into compliance with federal laws or risk losing over $1 million a biennium in federal funds. Senate Bill 40 allowed the OSP to use the Internet to distribute information about sex offenders. The OSP was ready to roll with the new site in September of 1999, but a group of 10 sex offenders and their families filed suit and won an injunction blocking the agency from launching the new site. In 2003, the Oregon State Court of Appeals finally lifted the injunction allowing state police to put up the website. But here we are 2 years later, and still no statewide centralized website, and as was stated by Representative Crummel, one of only two states in the union, ourselves in South Dakota. The one caveat I'd put on this is that I find it amazing that in our world today that sex offenders use the internet to find their victims, and in fact almost 25% of the victims that are found are over the internet, yet we can't use the internet to find the sex offender. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Ms. Howell, appreciate your hard work on this issue. Good job.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crummel.
May I just add one thing?
Of course.
Thank you. I would just like to point out that there are a number of groups that have supported this legislation. The Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Chiefs of Police, the State Sheriff's Association, Crime Victims United, State Police Officers Association, Sex Offender Supervision Network, And the Defense Lawyers Association helped us write amendments to the bill on the House side that were put into the bill there, and to my knowledge are neutral on the bill at this time. And so thank you again, Madam Chair, and if any questions come up at all during the dialogue, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3486? I'm going to close the public hearing, open the work session.
Move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 3486 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I would like to comment. I appreciate Mr. Dole's point that the Internet is used so well by the people finding the victims and the irony that exists that we're not making good use of it to kind of retaliate.
Thank you.
Motion was
to move the bill to the floor with a due pass.
I'm like, what was the motion? That's why. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'm going to let the Senate President carry this. All right.
Madam Chair.
Sir Atkinson?
Doesn't that make Representative Crummell the most successful House member at getting things through the Rules Committee?
I think that's pretty true. I think he had one he didn't quite get through, or he didn't like the form that it got through, but he still got the bill through. So.
Should I stand up and take a bow now? Thank you, Madam
Chair. He certainly made more appearances before the committee than anybody else.
Okay. Representative Barnhart, you're here, I believe, on House Bill 3021.
26,
29. Okay, all right. Open a public hearing. Why don't you come on forward?
I thought this was the other one. No, I still see it. He was going to come testify. I know, but he's there.
Anyway, why don't you tell us about this bill and why you think it should pass?
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11. House Bill 2649A comes to you unanimously from the House. This is a government efficiency bill. Modern technology has given us mechanisms, and you just passed the bill off to the floor dealing with other aspects of the same technology, that is the use of the web to provide information usable to people. This will allow, but not require, municipal corporations to publish full budget summaries on their own websites with just a newspaper notice that would include the title of the budget summary, the URL of the website, that is the place you can find it on the web.
I know.
A notice of the time and place of the budget hearing, a phone number and address where a paper copy or a facsimile copy of the budget summary can be ordered. Currently, municipal corporations, including special districts, community colleges, school districts, cities and counties, must publish their full budget summaries in newspapers of general circulation within their jurisdictions. This publication requirement forces municipal corporations to purchase significant amounts of advertising space. Now, there are two other alternative ways they can do it. They can mail each resident a copy of the budget summary, or they can pass them out in the territory of the municipal corporation to each household. Obviously, very small ones might do that, but most use the newspaper publication. This bill will not affect municipal corporations that prefer to continue publishing their budget summaries in the other ways that I've mentioned. It will provide them an additional alternative. The main point of discussion during public hearings on the bill in the House in the General Government Committee were accountability and record keeping. So I want to address the three main concerns that were raised on those issues. First, questions were raised about whether municipal corporations would keep as good records of their budget summaries as newspapers currently do. The answer is that special districts, school districts, and community colleges are already required by statute to maintain full budget records for 20 years. Cities and counties must maintain those records permanently. On the other hand, newspaper record keeping is voluntary and includes only the budget summaries that are provided to them and not the entire record of the budget. A second, allowing municipal corporations to publish the budget summaries online will encourage them to make all of their budget information more available, as the marginal cost of posting extra information on the web will be significantly reduced. investigative citizens who are interested in these budgets will have an easier time to get more complete information. And of course, a shrewd user of the web has a very easy time of taking very complex information and making it more usable by a judicious use of interlinking and so forth that are utterly impossible in a fine print newspaper advertisement. Third, the bill does address concerns about making budget summaries available to interested citizens who are not computer savvy or lack access to the Internet. This bill requires that municipal corporations post their budget summaries online. But they all have to publish, in addition to a notice of the web posting in the paper, a phone number and an address where a paper copy of the budget can be requested. In short, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill will revise an obsolete statute by allowing municipal corporations to take advantage of new technology while protecting and enhancing accountability. Mr. Gallagher has suggested, and I've agreed, to an informal interim process with local government, newspapers, and others to discuss the whole issue of public notice and how best to provide it more generally. This bill is a toe in the water, Madam Chair. Please hold a work session and move it to the floor and pass it. If there are problems with this method of giving notice to the public that we have not anticipated, passing this bill will allow us to learn what those are so that we can either fix them or retreat from this process to the more traditional ones. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Senator Shields looks like he has a question.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm looking at this through the eyes of one who's been on the board of a community college for 4 years, and it seems to me that it would reduce the hassle factor significantly and would probably also save us some dollars. I'm interested in saving dollars whenever I can in a community college situation.
Representative Barnhart, did you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, Senator Escobar, my co-sponsor on this bill thinks that we would save something in the neighborhood of $3 million biennium spread out over the entire state, small amounts for each of these municipal corporations in this method. Now, the newspapers have said they believe this is a small percentage of their advertising revenue. I'm not sure who is right, but certainly the ads going into the paper, even if they were in large print, would be smaller than publishing the entire summary in very fine print.
Right.
So, Madam
Chair. Sarah Atkinson.
Madam Chairwoman. So, the news, I have a disdain for task forces, but the.
No, this will be an informal.
The newspapers will be at this informal, not so formal task force of stakeholders. Whatever.
Mr. Gallagher has assured me that they will.
Can he nod? He won't nod, but they won't be there.
Well, I will simply represent as to what our conversation was earlier. Perhaps our position has changed in the meantime.
It's just more complicated than a nod. Tom Gallagher representing the newspapers. I think there's a great deal of work to be done on this, and we're going to convene the group. The newspapers are going to do this, and they're going to take a look at all of the implications here. The cost savings implications are certainly there, but there's a reason why things have been historically published. The budgets have been put out. There's a lot of new technology here. While this bill approaches most of the pieces of that technology, it doesn't get all of it. And there's the public policy piece here as to how people get available for this. So we are going to take a look and do this research. We've invited Representative Barnhart and the cities and counties to sit down with us on this. I don't know that anything will come out of this except that we'll all be better informed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Dave Earhart of the Rogue River Press is the publisher of my favorite newspaper in America, second to the Wall Street Journal. And he, in that little newspaper in Rogue River, depends upon public notice for part of his revenue to support the. And actually, people in the Rogue River Press read public notices. Every public notice is read. It's a little weekly. So are you telling me that he's going to be represented at this non-formal, formal task force meeting?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, he's probably going to be one of the major representatives there. The issue here is the different uses different people make of this. In smaller communities, people use the community newspapers probably more so than they do the internet to pick up local news. That data is not readily available as to how people use that, how many people do use the internet, how many people customarily would go to the internet rather than the newspaper. There's also a good argument that what appears in the newspaper is not in as usable a form, and that there can be some connectivity between the newspaper and the internet, that notices, titles, total summaries, and so forth are valuable to reach a broader audience, and that you can use the internet to refer specific people. On the House side, we talked a great deal about the concept of, or the problem of revenue for community newspapers. And I think that's something that will be discussed. There are two sides to this, the revenue to the paper and then the cost to the community public body in that area. And that's why we, stopped arguing about this bill and are going to have to figure out how we both do the economics and the public input side and the permanency side and all the other values that newspapers have brought for the last 150 years.
Okie dokie.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I would like to just comment on a couple of those points. I have a number of community newspapers in my legislative district. I find many of them extremely useful papers, and so do my constituents. I would not bring this bill if I thought that doing so was going to be a significant detriment to those community newspapers. I've had conversation with two of the editors of those papers who recognize the value and importance of this bill, and who I hope will be involved in the newspaper's conversation. The bill itself is only references one notice that needs to be given. There are many, many other notices that governments give through the year by publication in the newspaper. Some notices are not required to be given by publication, and maybe they ought to be. I'm not sure that moving this notice to the internet in for at least some agencies or some municipalities is going to affect newspapers' income overall, because I happen to agree with Mr. Gallagher's point made in my office that there are some places, some notices that ought to be published in the newspapers that probably are not now required. Those generally tend to be short meeting notices and things of that sort. So I'm not at all sure that this is going to lead to a change in the situation of the small newspapers, but it will, if we do it right, help to improve notice to the public and increase government efficiency and streamlining all at the same time. Passing this one bill, it gives us a chance to see how it will work in dealing with this one notice, so that we can actually get to the issues that he raises in the future.
Thank you. Anything further? Sarah Shields.
Well, I'm just thinking out loud here. I would think that in some of the smaller communities, such as Senator Atkinson's referring to, that local corporation may choose to stick with the newspaper, recognizing that maybe the populace doesn't use the internet as much. And in other settings, and again, I'm thinking about Mount Hood Community College, it would be much more appropriate to do it this way. It doesn't force an entity to switch. It just broadens the options.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate you joining us. For the record, I have Michelle Deister, League of Oregon Cities, Athena Squire, Special Districts, Lori Satsonfield, Community Colleges, and Ben Penhowell, Association of Oregon Counties, all in favor of the bill. Mm-hmm. Do you all wish to add anything else?
Or do you want us to vote on the bill? I mean, you know.
Well, that's not going to happen today either.
That's bad.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. I am submitting written testimony to cut down on your time here, but I would like to point out examples of what is currently required to be published in the newspapers. You'll see samples of forms, and basically they are three columns of numbers, lists by fund, generally speaking, of just general categories that don't really tell the average reader a whole lot about what it is that they're looking at. We would argue that by having the option of putting your web address and where this information can be found. You also have access to a bunch of additional supplemental information that will help put this information in context and will help the reader better understand what it is that they're looking at, and we think that's a good thing. To Representative Barnhart's point, yes, this is optional. There are probably some communities that will continue to use their local newspaper. And go ahead, Lori.
Lori Satinsville, the Oregon Community College Association, here representing community colleges in Oregon. I don't have a lot to add to what's been said already in the essence of time. I did submit written testimony from Rogue Community College, who estimates in their budget they spend approximately $6,000 a year to publish in their budgets to the web or to the papers, the various newspapers in the area. And Linda Warren, who's the chief financial officer down there, estimated with that kind of money they could add three additional class sections and could be taught to approximately 60 more citizens. And as you know, community colleges are looking for money anywhere that they can. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you. Ms. Squire.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the interest of, I can tell what you would like to do is close this public hearing, I'll just express special district support for the bill and just echo the comments of Ms. Deister that nothing in this bill is mandatory for local government to utilize this form of budget publishing, and the possibility for local governments to provide additional information on the Internet, which is not currently something that they would be able to easily reference in via the newspaper publishing noticing requirements, may be actually more beneficial than the current method.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Penhall, come on up.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Penhall, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. There's not a lot that I can add. I think it's been said what Representative Barnhart presented and the witnesses before me. Just want you to know that the Association of Oregon Counties supports the measure and would encourage you to pass it to the floor.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Penhall? Appreciate you joining us. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2649. All right.
Are you losing the
numbers? Yeah. We need to adjourn at 3, and so I'm not going to be able to get through public hearings and possible work sessions on the three bills that we have left. Chair would open a work session for the purpose of drafting and bill introduction for two measures. This is extremely painful for me, folks, but the chair would move that we approve the drafting and introduction of a bill related to school finance and one related to disclosure of the names of people whose cremated remains are stored at the Oregon State Hospital. Your vote in favor of the bill draft and introduction request does not signify your support or opposition to the substance of the measure, and I can guarantee you that neither one of these bills will delay the end of the session.
Senator?
Senator Ringo.
Is there any detail on the one relating to school finance?
No.
Can we put 81 days in there?
No.
Can I ask where the request comes from?
You can.
Yeah?
I'm not going to answer.
Why?
I'll tell you later.
Will you tell me later?
Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, I'd rather have that information for voting.
I understand that.
Okay.
But you're not going to.
Okay.
Is
this the one that would impact harvest operations in state forests?
No, actually, is not.
Okay.
We drafted a bill relating to school finance last week, and at the request of Senator Carter, she may have let that be used by someone in a higher office than she. So.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I
don't understand how you. What are you people
would you
talking
please?
About? I'm like,
aww.
I don't get the code. What am I voting on? How
the
many?
The motion.
On two bills?
Yes, for not. Drafting and introductions.
No.
Okay.
Senator Ringo? How should I vote, Madam Chair?
The Senate President is probably watching. He and I would prefer an aye vote.
I feel his presence.
else.
But I still understand the language.
Chair, based on how you described those bills, I will vote yes.
Thank you.
On those bills, those bill requests.
I've never voted in the presence of the omnipotent one before. But I'll vote yes.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Thank you for your courtesies.
I need a vocabulary book so I can understand all these things.
I'll explain it to you on the floor tomorrow.
I look forward to the tutoring.
Okay. Let's do a public hearing on House Bill 3021. You want to tell us about the bill?
Sure. We don't have amendments.
Yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
Thanks, Madam Chair and Committee. House Bill 3021 allows ballots to list names of all political parties that have nominated a candidate for election. Representative Barker couldn't attend the hearing today, but he submitted a written letter of support and wanted the record to reflect that he supports this bill.
Okay. Mr. Burke, why don't you come on up? Mr. Lanning. For the record, before you guys get started, I have no one signed up for House Bill 3349. That being the case and the fact that we're out of time, we're going to set that one over to another day's agenda. We'll move, take public testimony on 3021 and hopefully have the last few minutes to do 3238. So, Mr. Burke, Mr. Lanning, why should we pass this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Burke with the Libertarian Party of Oregon. I think this bill provides opportunities for parties to work together around good candidates. Under current law, it is possible for a candidate to win the nomination of more than one political party, but only the political party the candidate belongs to may appear next to his or her name on the ballot. With this bill, it makes it possible for the names of every party nominating that candidate to appear on the ballot if the candidate approves. So in essence, what it does is it gives political parties more choices. It also gives candidates more choices, but doesn't force either of them to do anything. There have been a lot of times where we've wanted to back both good Republicans and Democrats, but our rank and file demanded that we have a ballot presence. This would provide a way to prevent that. And if the candidate in question did not want our endorsement, in our case, the candidate could simply say no. This has broad bipartisan support. Representative Krupp is a sponsor. Representative Vakian spoke in favor of it. Leadership on both sides supports this bill. And this is not anything new. The so-called fusion candidate law that is being proposed to you exists in a variety of states and has not caused voter confusion, has not caused any problems. And I believe it is good civics because it allows parties to concentrate on good people rather than just their own names. I'd be happy to answer questions. Most of the time when there has been questions or opposition to this, if I've had a chance to talk with them, it's resolved that. It's just a very simple idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Burke?
Hi.
Sarah Ringo.
What other states use this?
At present, New York, California, South Carolina, South Dakota, Idaho, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire.
And they use it in all levels of their elections?
According to Richard Winger of Ballot Access News, the answer to that question is yes. The best example is New York, where you have the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, in addition to the Republicans and Democrats. And many times, they will nominate the same people. So you might see Jane Smith, Democrat, Liberal. In New Hampshire, you see that all the time. I do know that in the state of Illinois, in some areas, the fusion candidates are allowed. But this has not caused problems in any of these states, has not caused voter confusion in any of these states, carries no fiscal impact, and it is a good way for people to look beyond the narrow limitations of their own party.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lanning.
Thank you. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're not in support of this bill, and I'm sorry we didn't wait on the other side. It got under our radar and we missed it. But we think it does provide confusion to voters, and we think it's confusing to us when we take a look at it. The major parties and minor parties have different nominating processes that they go through, and that's one difference. We think that voters deserve to see each party and each candidate listed separately, and we sort of view political parties like a team uniform, and that they're meant to define the candidates on the issues, and for a candidate on the ballot on the same line to be wearing two different uniforms or playing for two different teams seems confusing. And so we oppose it for that reason. And we understand that in New York, the fusion entity that they have in New York is different in that it has candidates and parties listed separately on different lines rather than all on the same line. That's what we understood New York to be. And because we were looking for some kind of a compromise. If we didn't like this, what did we like? And as far as New York goes, that was our understanding. So the candidate would be listed with a party, and then on another line, if they're supported by another party or nominated by another party, they would be on a separate line. Maybe that's just part of the confusion.
So that their name would appear in two different places?
Yes. That's what we understood the New York solution to be.
Is that right?
I could speak to that if you'd like.
Go ahead.
The problem that we looked at that, and we worked with a lot of people that have dealt with third parties on this. Problem is when you get two people with the same name. For example, some years ago there was a state representative named Bob Tiernan. And we also had an active member whose name was Bob Tiernan. And under the process described, that would create confusion. But the fact of the matter is this: we've had a number of people, both Republicans and Democrats, come to us and ask us for our endorsement. And I know that there have been times when people have come to the Pacific Greens and asked for their endorsement. And the fact is, if they don't want it, fine. But if they do want it, our rank and file just doesn't ever allow it to happen because they're a member of our respective parties and they want a ballot presence. This provides a way to have a ballot presence around a candidate we like without necessarily fielding an additional candidate. And both Republicans and Democrats have asked people for that. There have also been some occasions where the Republicans or the Democrats did not field a candidate. It happens 7 or 8 races every year. And somebody has won both. And they would like it to appear. Representative McPherson was an example. Representative Krupp was an example. And you too, Senator Brown. And so these are occasions.
Scary though it may seem.
You know, and it provides more choices. But again, I think we need to give credit to our candidates who have the right to say no and know what's best for their district. And we have to give credit to our voters who are not confused in these states. So why would they be confused in Oregon? I don't think that people here are any less intelligent here than in any other state. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Sir
Ringo.
So both parties could be listed. Would there be the opportunity to say which is the primary affiliation?
Under the bill, the way it is worded is that the name will be added. And this.
What name would be added?
If you ran.
I ran as a Democrat, but I get the write-in ballot for the Republican Party. The ballot would read Kate Brown, Democrat, and Republican?
It would read Kate Brown, Democrat, Republican. And
I'm just trying to... And would you expect that because Democrat is listed first, that sends the signal that's the primary affiliation?
Yes. That was discussed in the State and Federal Affairs Committee. And a number of lawyers have looked at this, and our legislative council has looked at this, and we're all very satisfied that the first name is the name of primary affiliation. If this is a problem with the candidate doesn't have to accept the secondary one. It was also posited that if there was any confusion at all, it could be solved administratively.
Administratively, in what way? The Secretary of State could
draft rules that would impact how the ballot is put together?
That's correct. It's, you know, this isn't a new situation. This has been dealt with in all of the states that I have mentioned, and the way it works in the states where the name and then the parties are listed, the party of registration is always listed first.
Okay.
Thank you all very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3021. Senator Shields, do you want to pound the gavel? Thank you. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3238. Mr. Allen, Ms. Frankie, Mr. Moskowitz, why don't you all come on forward and we'll battle it out.
Can you guys stay for the next 10 minutes? I've got to go.
Can I walk out with you?
Yeah. Senator Shields, we're going to let you take the gavel.
Anybody else leaving?
Senator Ringo will be back. I've got to go. You want me to go to this meeting? Trust me.
I trust you, Madam Chair. Well, it's just you and me, folks.
Mr. Chair and member of the committee, Patrick Allen with the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. You've got in front of you -A16 and -A17 amendments to House Bill 3238A. The difference in the amendments revolves around Section 4 having to do with waiver of rules. Both amendments contain a technical fix to Section 3 having to do with small business fiscal impact statements. I'd be happy to talk about that if you want, but the real issue is in waiver. The A16 amendments simply delete the waiver language. The A17 amendments add some further shape to the waiver provision. The issue, it seems to me, comes to this. Right now, when application of a rule in a particular set of circumstances yields a result that is not what's intended, has a cost to benefit that's out of whack, achieves an absurd result, right now agencies basically have two alternatives they can take. One is to say that they will they'll write a new rule or amend the rule to fix it. The other is to simply allow that absurd outcome to stand. And what this does is provide effectively a third way to deal with that outcome. An example might be an agency that does professional licensing and has a continuing education requirement. Someone gets called up to serve in the military and misses for a particular period some portion of that continuing education. An agency that has lots of that happen, where they're in that industry, there's a lot of that kind of service, could go and write a rule and deal with that. A one-off circumstance, though, perhaps the most appropriate outcome might be for the agency to waive the requirement for that period, allow the person to come back and catch up. And that would be a way for that tool to allow an outcome that's not desirable to avoid occurring. In either case, either set of amendments, whatever your druthers are, would be acceptable, and we'd like to move forward. A couple of dates that have been added to the bill. The bill now provides for a sunset of the waiver authority January of 2010. Working with the League of Women Voters, they had a preference for a somewhat earlier sunset, but this is the date that conforms to the style manual that you've adopted in rule. Also, there's a requirement for the Department of Consumer and Business Services, where my office exists, to report back. This calls for a report at the beginning of the 2007 session. Again, the League would have preferred a 2009 report. My office is guaranteed to exist through the beginning of the 2007 session, and so it's mainly to make sure that there's someone there to do the work.
Questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to turn on written testimony. Liz Frankel for the League of Women Voters. We were told by the chair to go and work this out. So we tried. And the results were A17. As you will see in our written testimony, it wasn't quite what we wanted. We look and we're told this is an experiment. And so we were trying to put some sideboards and some ways of controlling this experiment. It does seem that this is a fairly short period, though it's been broadened a little bit for the report. Our reason for concern among other things, was the fact that this affects all agencies, not just one category, not just one, but all agencies. And nobody has been able to give us any idea. We haven't a clue as to what the usefulness of this or the impact. However, we tried, and we will not oppose the bill with these amendments.
Which amendments are you referring to?
17.
17. Thank you. Thank you.
Dave?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, my name is David Moskowitz with the Wild Salmon Center in Portland, Oregon, and apologize for not weighing in on this earlier. We understood that this bill was not going to move forward, and I'm sorry to rain on the parade to amend this, but we're opposed to this bill. It's unnecessarily complicates the executive branch function here. There's no, as far as I can see, there's no money to pay for all of the work that agencies have to undertake with the requirements of this bill. This bill requires them to form committees, advisory committees, that assess the fiscal impact to business. That's an extraordinarily complicated area. I worked for National Marine Fisheries Service several years ago, and we had to assess that, the economic effects of different rules on business through our rule setting on the Endangered Species Act, and we had to hire contractors to do that economic assessment. This is saying that an advisory committee can do that, and there's no money to pay for accomplishing that. It's a very broad requirement for the state agencies that will grind to a halt rulemaking. We'd like to see maybe a list of what absurd results come from rules that agencies don't already have tools to address. It'd be nice to know how many examples there are of absurd results from rulemaking. Certainly, there are always issues. When you pass rules, you're always going to have, for whatever situation you want to find, you're going to find a small number of problems where it has an absurd result. But generally, agencies have the tools to address the effects of their rules. The legislative function exists for you to direct agencies to do certain things, and that's by amending the statutes to give the executive branch some direction. This is a reopener, and it actually requires the agencies to review the rules every 3 years. That's a very short time period to know what the effects are. So we're opposed to this. We also think it is, if it is an experiment, there ought to be some kind of a sunset timer when you would revisit it, if you even advance this at all, and we would advise against it.
Thank you. Senator Ringo, any questions?
No, I find the whole idea very intriguing of waiving absurd regulations. I just want to decide which ones are absurd.
Senator Shields, if I could respond to a couple of points that Mr. Moskowitz raised.
Okay.
I'm lost quickly. We're on the Dash A17 amendments because we worked very hard to try to wring fiscal impact out of this bill, and it does not have, it's identified, I believe, as having a minor fiscal impact. There is no requirement for the formation of advisory committees. That stays as in current law, where it's suggested but not required. Agencies today, as they have been for nearly 20 years, are already required to estimate the fiscal impact of rules. So what this does is provides input to the agency from advisory committees that they would form on the design of rules to help inform that already required fiscal. There is no requirement for a review of rules every 3 years in this bill. There's a one-time review that's required. And Mr. Moskowitz has suggested a sunset, which is an excellent idea. You'll find in Section 4B of the Dash 17 amendments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there others that have signed up for that?
No.
I find this bill more than intriguing. I find it confusing. If there's no other testimony on it, I'm going to close the hearing on 3238, and that concludes our business, and we're adjourned for the day.